afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. We're in room 532 in Alaska State Capitol here in Juneau, Alaska. Today is Thursday, March 17th, 2016. Many members of the committee are honoring St. Patrick's Day in some attire of green. I noticed quite a few green ties on the gentlemen that are here today. Before us is a review of Alaska's enterprise agencies, corporations. First on the agenda is going to be Alaska Aerospace Corporation, followed by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. With me in the committee room today, Co-Chairman Kelly, welcome. Vice Chairman Michicki. Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon.
Senator Dunleavy.
Hello.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
And Senator Hoffman was here a few moments ago and just needed to step out of the room, so he should be back shortly. And I'm Senator Anna McKinnon, co-chair of Finance, chairing today's meeting. Mr. Campbell, President and CEO of Alaska Aerospace Corporation, are you online and available to testify?
Madam Chair, I am, and I appreciate this time. I'm available when you're ready.
We have a Word document before us. Please proceed. We sent you a list of 12 questions and are hoping to have those questions answered.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Craig Campbell. I'm the President and CEO of Alaska Aerospace Corporation, and it's my pleasure to be here to give this presentation of Alaska Aerospace activities this past year. Because I have to do this via teleconference, I provided the written copy that you should have before you and online for others to review for their convenience. So, this is a good opportunity to put some facts on the record concerning Alaska Aerospace, to counter much of the misinformation that has been presented by detractors during public testimony, and even from some legislators during committee and floor sessions. So I want to spend a little bit of time clarifying the record and giving you the facts of Alaska Aerospace over the last year in our history. Alaska Aerospace Corporation is currently a state-owned corporation established by the legislature in state statute. AAC is the only government or private sector company in the state to provide the services and capabilities for space launch and aerospace development. The University of Alaska also has a very active aviation education curriculum. The University of Alaska Anchorage and the University of Alaska Fairbanks operates the Boca Flat Launch Facility and the Satellite Downlink Operation under the Geophysical Institute. The Boca Flat Launch Facility is primarily funded by NASA for suborbital studies of the aurora. AAC is exempt from many State Department regulations, requirements, and the State Procurement Code. But we remain under the State Department of the Military and Veterans Affairs for administrative oversight only. As part of our existence, the legislature provided in statute that AAC has bombing authority. However, we have never utilized that capability. Therefore, we have no outstanding standing debt or current liabilities. But AAC is not the same company that came before you in February 2015. Much has happened to move the company away from state dependency into a true commercial marketplace. At a time when oil and gas prices are at damagingly low values for our state, at a time when there is tremendous pressure on our state budget to support the essential services of Alaska's spectrum government, I am pleased to be here to give you a positive story about your aerospace company that demonstrates our success at no longer being dependent on state funding while creating an insurgence in aerospace business for our company. But first, I'd like to set the stage for my presentation. Historically, Alaska Aerospace has been solely viewed as the Kodiak Launch Complex. The measurement of our success was based on the number of launches from Kodiak and the revenues generated from those launches. While that model proved successful for many years, the past 5 years have shown that Alaska Aerospace can no longer be successful, a successful company, by rocket launches from Kodiak alone. Let me explain. From 1996 until 2011, AAC did not receive any state funding for operations and sustainment. The company operated within the revenues received from the launches of Kodiak. During that period, AAC successfully launched 16 rockets, all for the federal government. However, as the federal government changed focus on missions, the lucrative government contracts that AAC had relied upon quickly came to an end. With no other business units within the company, the future financial position of AAC quickly became a serious issue. In 2011, my predecessor requested $4 million in the governor's budget, which the legislature approved to support our daily operations and sustainment of AAC until such time as we could secure more launches. In the state fiscal year 2012, AAC again requested and received an additional $4 million in general funds for operations and sustainment. This was followed in state year 2013 with a request for $8 million, which was also approved. In October 2012, I was appointed as the new president and chief executive officer for AAC. During my subsequent presentations before both the House and Senate Finance Committees, I made the pledge that AAC would become a profitable company, that we would diversify, and that we would implement a long-term budget plan to reduce state general funds for operations and sustainment by $2 million a year. Let me restate that. The commitment we made was we were at $8 million. We would reduce every subsequent year after that by $2 million down to zero. So what this did is in SY 2015, the budget request was reduced to $6 million, and our 2016 budget request targeted $4 million. In addition to the operations and sustainment funds, AAC also requested $25 million in state year 2013 to pursue medium lift expansion capabilities at Kodiak. The legislature passed this capital fund appropriation with a specific expenditure plan which stated that AAC could spend an initial $3 million for engineering, environment, permitting, and associated preparatory efforts. Once a contract was secured, AAC could expend an additional $10 million in site development. That would be work to support the expansion of the program. However, the remaining $12 million could not be spent until all additional financing for full construction of the medium lift facilities, known as Launch Pad 3, had been secured. In 2014, AAC initiated the engineering environmental processes. Later that year, AAC awarded to Lockheed Martin the right to proceed with medium lift development of for the Athena 2S, provided they secured a launch customer for the vehicle. Following the election of Governor Walker, in light of the state's fiscal condition situation, Governor Walker issued Administrative Order 271 in December 2014, halting discretionary spending on mega projects. AAC immediately ceased all work on the Kodiak Launch Complex medium lift project. Unfortunately, Lockheed Martin was not able to close the business case on the Athena 2S, so no work has been done since that date on developing medium lift Pacific Spaceport Complex Alaska, formerly known as the Kodiak Launch Complex. Nor have there been any costs charged to this project since that time. The medium lift environmental assessment is in the final stage of approval with the Federal Aviation Administration, and we expect a final report within the next few weeks. There are no further costs associated with the EA. Currently, we have $2,315,249 of the original $3 million that remains in the AAC account. In January 2015, AAC offered $22 million of the medium lift appropriation back to the state for reappropriation to other state agencies. That was accomplished last year, and that money no longer resides in any AAC account. Concurrent with this, Governor Walker requested that AAC immediately reduce all state fund general funds for operations sustainment to zero in the state fiscal year 2016. We agree, effectively terminating any future state funding to AAC with last year's budgets. While you may recall that last year when I appeared before you, there was questions about the administration's action to zero us out in the budget. You may also recall that I support Governor Walker's action. I speak here today still in favor of that action. There are no state funds included in the state 2017 state budget for AAC. Finally, in response to questions, you may also recall that I stated AAC would be exploring the possibility to privatize the company so Alaska could retain a viable aerospace industry without requirements for state funds. So here we are today. No money requested in the budget, and 1 year further down the road. And we have not been idle. In January 2015, AAC presented the administration a point paper recommending that privatization be considered as an alternative to shutting down the corporation. In February 2015, the AAC Board of Directors authorized the company to proceed with evaluating alternative organizational structures and business models for AAC. In March 2015, AAC hired Nossman LLP, a legal firm, to conduct a study. They evaluated 9 different scenarios for potential transformation of the company away from state government. During the May 2015 board meeting, Nossman presented these options to the board, and the board directed that 6 scenarios be further developed for evaluation at the November meeting. Governor Walker was briefed on the board's direction in August 2015 by myself, Dr. Bob McCoy, the AAC board chair, and DMVA Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole was also in attendance. No action was requested of Governor Walker. AEC simply wanted to make sure the administration was kept abreast of the board's progress. During the November 2015 meeting, the board unanimously passed Resolution 1506, a resolution recommending to the governor that he pursue the transfer of the Alaska Aerospace Corporation to a public-private partnership. So despite press releases by some elected officials that claim, and I will quote, the Alaska Aerospace Corporation needs to take the Alaska legislature's message to privatize seriously and not drop the process while using state funds to stay afloat, unquote. The AAC Board of Directors has recommended that we be transition to a public-private partnership. Furthermore, AAC has not received any state funds since FY 2015, so our operations there are wholly paid for by customer receipts and cash reserves. It is our intention to not use state funding in the future, but rather to privatize and be part of our state's economic solution, bringing money into the state, employing Alaskans, and diversifying our economy away from being so heavily dependent on natural resource extraction and sales. So, let me highlight the economic value of AAC to our state since becoming operational in 1996. I am hearing here, like I do, the repeated pounding of the drum, and I quote again, Alaska Aerospace has never made any money in its history, unquote. That's absolutely false. As I already mentioned, for the first 15 years, Alaska Aerospace launched 16 rockets and never received a single state dollar for operations and sustainment. Facts are facts. During that period, AAC financially contributed to the state through the contracts we held with the federal government. But let me further present the fact that AAC has actually been a very positive economic driver for Alaska. Since being established, the state has invested $58.7 million in AAC. Now, I'll break that down. $30.2 million is in operations and sustainment funding that we previously talked about. $22.6 million is in the capital funds for infrastructure development and deferred maintenance at the Pacific Spaceport Complex, Alaska, again, formerly the Kodiak Launch Complex. And $5.9 million is coming through the University of Alaska Science and Technology Funds for support of students, interns, and other things that we do in Alaska. In total, AAC maintains a physical asset base valued at approximately $57 million, and following reconstruction of damaged facilities, which will be approximately $35 million. So, in return, AAC has generated nearly $300 million in new money, non-state revenues, accounting for 84% of total revenues for the company. In further analysis, of the $58.7 million in state funds, only $30.2 million was for operations and sustainment. The rest was directly into capital projects for education programs that facilitated our ability to attract new business. Therefore, the state received around $9 in new money for every dollar invested for operations and sustainment. Now, am I happy that the state had to provide $30.2 million to AAC? Absolutely not. You've heard me before. I've testified before. I do not want to have a government-dependent operation. So that is why I agreed with Governor Walker to eliminate state funding last year, to return the $22 million in CIP funding to the state, and to support establishment of a public-private partnership company. By being a public-private partnership, there is virtually no risk that the state would have to provide further operations and sustainment funding, and it presents a business model for the new company to potentially pay the state back the $30.2 million over time. If AAC is shut down, that $30.2 million investment is lost forever. But let me bring this closer to home. Our last launch in August 2014 generated significant economic benefits to the community of Kodiak. Over $1.3 million in hotels, B&B, and lodge room rentals were there. Approximately $835,000 in food, beverage, and incidental sales were there. $250,000, $250,000 vehicle rentals, and another $250,000 for logistics support was spent in the community during that launch campaign. This resulted in a direct positive impact to Kodiak of $2.7 million in new money to the community. This is in addition to the $2.8 million contract AAC had with MOFET to conduct the launch. When all direct investments are accounted for, the 2014 launch injected over $5.5 million of new money into Alaska, and I'll footnote that to say, and that was done in about a nine-month period, not even a full year. Using a standard economic multiplier, the direct, indirect, and least positive economic benefit was at least $8 million for that launch, with the majority being spent in Kodiak and Sandpoint. In terms of the macro evaluation of economic benefit derived to the state by AAC, when a standard economic multiplier is applied to the total AAC budget of $356.7 million, all revenues we receive, AAC has provided over $500 million in economic benefit to the state. I think that is a positive message that is not understood by nearly enough people, but these are the facts. Before I close, I want to return to one more important point. For too long, AAC has been synonymous with Kodiak. Our past behavior has validated that this assumption was correct. However, the past 2 years, AAC has dramatically changed, and this is no longer an accurate view of AAC. We are aggressively diversifying the company, so we are no longer solely dependent on launches from TSCA, and have the ability to adjust resources as markets change. Let me provide some examples. We have a contract with Planet Labs as distributor of the rapid-eye satellite constellation imaging data of Alaska. No matter who buys Alaska imaging data, AAC receives a commission. AAC is also pursuing installation and operation of data downlink Earth stations in both northern Alaska and along the equator to allow us downlink data and do image processing as part of our vertical integration for imaging services. We have initiated work on unmanned aircraft systems, UAS. We are part of the University of Alaska's Pan-Pacific FAA UAS test range, and we have received FAA authority to apply for unmanned aircraft systems UAS certificate of authority for commercial operations statewide. We are the only agency in the state, besides the university, with this FAA approval. In fact, we have a partnership agreement with two companies right now, commercial companies, that are planning operations in Alaska later this year. We have a contract with Rocket Lab USA to provide range support and launch director services for their first four Electron launches from their New Zealand facility. Those are scheduled for 2016 and 2017. This will ultimately lead to launches from Alaska projected for late 2017 or late 2018. AAC received $2.6 million in federal funds in the FY 2015 budget for capital improvements at TSCA to support future federal operations from Alaska. AAC has also requested in an additional $5 million of federal funds within the FY 2017 budget. The AAC Board of Directors passed a resolution in February 2016 authorizing AAC to proceed with development of a joint venture for marketing the Range Safety and Telemetry System, the RSTS, worldwide. The AAC Board has also passed a resolution in February authorizing AAC to proceed with establishing a wholly owned subsidiary to provide launch services worldwide. This is kind of important. These launch services are the services currently provided to PSCA. We already have the people. But our intent is to expand the business unit to obtain work at other launch facilities, thereby generate revenues when the team is in Alaska. AAC is actively pursuing development of an equatorial launch site to complement the current polar capabilities of PSCA. It means the intent of the board that AAC have the ability to serve customers both equatorial and polar requirements. This would significantly increase potential revenues as the majority of launches require equatorial orbits. And finally, AAC is in the final negotiations with the customer that will use PSCA with the first launch in 2017. This will be a multi-year, multi-launch program that has the potential of being a prime customer for the next 5 to 10 years. While I can't provide any further information in this due to the sensitive nature of the contract negotiations, I can say that we do expect a public announcement forthcoming probably in the month of April from the customer. What else can I say? I guess I'll close by telling you that for 40 years ago, AAC had over 40 state employees. Today, we have only 16. Over the past 20 years, I have not provided any cost of living allowance, COLA increase, to any of our state employee workforce. While the state budget has included COLA, we did not implement it at AAC and never received the money from the state. We also have not provided raises to our state employees in the past 4 years. I recognize that AAC employees are well paid and that the state is facing a serious fiscal challenge. Alaska Aerospace Corporation is transforming into a diversified company, and in the past year has demonstrated the resilience of our workforce to create new opportunities and secure new business for Alaska. So in conclusion, AAC wants to be part of the solution. That is why our board has recommended to Governor Walker to proceed with the public-private partnership, to create the environment to allow AAC the potential to repay the state $30.2 million, and to diversify our economy at a time when we can ill afford to see more Alaskans unemployed. But we're sending a message to the world that Alaska is no longer an aerospace state. I appreciate your attention. Thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer your questions.
Thank you, President Campbell. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. General Campbell, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon and talking or giving us an update on what's going on with the Aerospace Corporation. We appreciate your efforts in downsizing from 40 to 16, like you talked about, of the employees that are there, and either disallowing or not having COLA come into the formula. But one of the questions I have for those employees that are out there of the Aerospace Corporation, are they under the PERS retirement system like the rest of the state employees?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, we are. The 16 we have today are all state employees, and they're in the state PERS program and the state health insurance program. That's partly why we want to build a public-private partnership, because at that point we'll be able to transition all the employees out of PERS and out of the state system. I know that will lower our costs and make us more attractive, and also take some of that burden away from the state.
Madam Chairman, if I could continue.
Senator Olson.
It's my understanding, or it's not my understanding, but the way we have it is the communities that are out there paying 20%+ of what's that liability is. What do you pay, Aerospace Corporation also pay for the PERS liability as well? And what percentage do you pay?
Senator Olson, yes, we provide our payroll every 2 weeks. We include funding for the obligations from the state. However, the PERS liabilities out there in the past, AAC has received funding support as part of the entire state in the PERS relief program. So we receive some of that funding that we applied against the PERS liability.
Again, I ask the question, Madam Chairman, if I could.
Senator Olson.
What does this Aerospace Corporation pay in percentage to the PERS contribution like the communities do at 22%?
22.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we pay the same as any state department, state agency, and I couldn't tell you right now what that percentage is. Whatever DMVA's allocation is, we're at the same level as DMVA.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. We'll contact the finance at Aerospace. We'd like to know under the new Gadsby rules, what you're carrying is the unfunded liability on the corporation for your employees. We probably would like to know if you had a termination study done when you reduced from your high to 16 employees and what that looks like on the pension system.
Madam Chair, this is Craig again. Yeah, we actually did had PERS do a study for us on the transition for the public-private partnership. I don't have it with me right here. We can provide that to the committee, but the cost that Alaska Aerospace would have to pay for the transition out of the state PERS system, we already did that report, and we can provide it to you.
And then just so that it doesn't go unchecked, from the Aerospace's perspective, you'd like to sell low to the state of Alaska at some $30 million. I see the investment at over $58 million with a hard-based physical asset of $57 million. So we've invested as the state, just under $60 million of cash received, great benefit for the people of Alaska and other things. But on an investment, from my perspective, we're looking at a return on what we've invested, not just a cash-out sale and with that lower number. So an average rate of return of 4.25% would have been a $2.5 million payment to the state of Alaska each year for that investment. Of course, that would have fluctuated up and down. That's simple math, not as the money went out. But I would disagree with what appears to be the $32 million investment being lost forever. I think I value you much greater than that, specifically under your leadership. There's greater value there, General Campbell, than I think is reflected in the statement that we have before us today.
Madam Chair, this is Craig again. So here's how that's done. The public-private partnership proposal that's with Governor Walker right now, the public portion would be to retain the assets. So the capital investment money that went into the Pacific Spaceport Complex Alaska would actually remain state assets. So that's why we're determining we wouldn't pay that back, because it's still part of the asset base that was invested there when the initial facility was built and the improvements have been made. So if that facility were then to be divested from the state, you're absolutely right. The additional capital funds that were placed into that facility should also be recouped by the state. But the way the structure is that we have before the governor right now is the private sector would be the operating side. The public sector would actually retain the assets and the full value of the assets on the state.
Thank you, General Campbell. Maybe we can get an update from the administration itself or from you later on the proposal for the public-private partnership. We've been left out of that loop, and possibly for right reasons as the idea matures. So any other questions on aerospace? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General Campbell, thanks for your overview. But I was curious on, you and I had talked about this a year ago, I'm curious on your range safety and telemetry systems, and can you, are you able to speak any more about that, and how's that going?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, I can. That was one of the points I raised about New Zealand and Rocket Lab, and we're actually pretty excited about that range safety. It's a mobile system, and we've never used it anyplace other than in Alaska. And so the team now, we've established a range safety team of people that are going to be FAA certified, not DOD or NASA certified, but FAA certified, to be able to use that facility at any range around the world. So our first contract is actually with Rocket Lab to do their services under an FAA license in New Zealand. And so we will have all our equipment shipped there. In fact, the equipment probably is going to leave in the next month. And our team will go down there and do the support for Rocket Lab's first four launches. Then we'll bring the equipment back and do the Alaska launches after we've certified the rocket, which is what we're going down for. And the joint venture that we're talking about is with another company that is very interested in marketing the RSTS on the east coast of the United States and the other locations that are farther away from Alaska than the Pacific region. And that joint venture envisions being able to provide services to DOD, NASA, and commercial customers at a number of locations up and down the east coast of the United States and possibly overseas. So that's totally different. Last year I was saying we were hoping we could take the RSTS and use it to generate funds. We're down to the point now we actually have a contract that's driving us to do that. We've got the team established and the FAA certification process underway, and we're negotiating a joint venture where we could actually use it with another company at other locations that we hadn't envisioned a year ago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Any other questions? General Campbell, thank you for joining us in Senate Finance today. There's no further questions. We'll follow up with you. I have one more question. Does the agency have any outstanding liabilities the legislature should be aware of? You said earlier that there was no debt obligation out there. Is there any other liabilities through contracts or other means that we should know about?
Madam Chair, potentially. I put together a short report. I can get that to the legislature also, and identifies if we were to be shut down, what liabilities could be created, such as the Rocket Lab contract. If we were to be shut down and not provide that service now, they'd be in a box as to how they would do range safety. It would probably cost them a lot of money to find an alternative source for it, and we'd probably want to have the state reimburse for some of that cost. So there are some liabilities if we're shut down. There are no liabilities other than the PERS that we get you the report on, and there's no bonding. I have no loans with any of the banks, so there are no traditional liabilities, but the liabilities that could be created is if we're shut down, I believe some of the customers that we have contracts with could seek remedies from the state.
General Campbell, how many contracts are out there, and what's the length of those contracts?
The Blackridge contract is about another 3 years. That's the distribution of the Rapidite satellite stuff. The Rocket Lab contract is just for this four launches. It's really a one-year contract. Off the top of my head, I'll do a better job than think off the top of my head. I'll get you a written response.
Thank you so much. With that, thank you for joining us, and I know that you have other things to do with your day.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease to switch over to Alaska Housing Finance. Brief at ease. Good afternoon. We're back on the record. It is 2:17. This is the Senate Finance Committee. If you're joining us online, before us we have enterprise agencies, and we are looking at a series of questions that my office has asked each of these agencies that are corporation existing somewhat at an arm's length away from general government. Mr. Butcher, you're leading off the conversation.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like me to begin?
Welcome to Senate Finance. Are there any opening questions to come before the committee before we start with Alaska Housing Finance? Seeing none, Mr. Butcher, the time is yours.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, this is Brian Butcher, CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I have with me the corporation's Budget Director, Les Campbell, our Chief Financial Officer, Mike Strand, and our Public Affairs Director, Stacey Schubert.
Mr. Butcher, it is sometimes difficult to break in to the audio when you're giving a presentation, so if you could pause slightly after each slide so we can make sure if there are questions that committee members can ask you at the appropriate time. Would that work?
I will do that, Madam Chair, absolutely.
Thank you. Please continue.
Slide one addresses question one: what is the strategic vision and value to Alaska? The corporation's mission statement is to provide Alaskans access to safe, quality, affordable housing. You also see a paragraph that touches on a lot of the different things we do at the corporation. We're a self-supporting public corporation with offices in communities, 16 communities statewide. I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but I would like to touch on a couple of the areas that have the greatest value to Alaska, what the corporation does. One of them is our mortgage programs. And our mortgage programs are geared towards affordable housing or workforce housing, and tend to be Alaskans that are creditworthy but have a more difficult time getting a mortgage, say, through some of the other secondary mortgage markets such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac than Alaska Housing. Examples of that are the tax-exempt first-time home buyers program that by federal law we are the only ones that can administer, the tax-exempt veterans mortgage program that also by federal law we are the only ones that can administer. In fact, there are only 5 states in the country that can offer a tax-exempt mortgage program for veterans: Wisconsin, Texas, Oregon, California, and Alaska. Rural loan program: most of the loans in rural Alaska are Alaska Housing loans, and multifamily loans is an area that we have a tremendous percentage of statewide. And so that is the area that tends to be the focus of the corporation. However, when discussing value to Alaska, I think it's important to note that when Alaska Housing has had to step up and take a bigger role in the state's mortgage business and housing market, they have. And a good example of that was in the late 80s when Alaska was in a recession and Fannie and Freddie no longer were particularly interested in doing business in Alaska. The foreclosure rates shot up through the roof, and I know many of the people in the room were here for that period of time and remember it. Alaska Housing at that point had over 90% of all of the mortgages that were being given. Had they not been around, the mortgage market and housing market would have shut down in the state. And you'll frequently hear bankers tell those stories as they have any discussions about Alaska Housing. So that's been a benefit that we hope to never have to give to the state of Alaska, but we've been there before. As part of that, there were thousands and thousands of mortgage foreclosures that came into the corporation. And the decision was made at the time not to flood the market, but to sit on them, to hold them, and to let them out as the market recovered. And even with that action, housing values dropped by about 50%, but they truly would have fallen through the floor if Alaska Housing hadn't, you know, made a wise decision at that time. Another aspect in terms of value to Alaska, and it's about half of what we do in terms of our employees, is public housing. We administer for HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, 1,600 public housing units in 14 communities around the state, as well as 5,000
housing choice vouchers that are vouchers that go to landlords for Alaskans around the state, and that pumps about $4 million a month into the private sector, into private landlords. And that's a 100% federally funded program that Alaska Housing administers for the federal government. And then lastly, Madam Chair, of course, we always keep an eye on our dividend and the value that has for Alaska and the benefit as well.
Mr. Butcher, I have questions. Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Butcher, some of the things that we're going through in this tough time for Alaska is looking at consolidation and best practices, looking for duplication of services either in the private sector or in other state agencies. You just asserted before the committee that you were handling a mortgage program for creditworthy Alaskans. And my question has to do with the activity of that particular component of what you're doing. Is your general private sector mortgage lending up, down, static? What does that portfolio look like?
Madam Chair, it is up quite a bit over the last couple of years. As you had mentioned, the private sector is who we work with in this. We're the secondary mortgage market. We don't have a storefront. We rely on banks, credit unions, mortgage companies to initiate the mortgages, and then we buy them from it. We've seen our mortgage activity over the last 2 years go up to about $500 million. So over that 2 year period, it's gone up about 21%. I believe last year, about 20% of the mortgages in the state were Alaska Housing.
So we're buying them on a secondary market, is that what you're telling me?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We serve a role similar to what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac serve, where if you walk into a mortgage company and you're looking for a mortgage, they take a look at where they can get the best rates, where they can get the best benefits. The benefit of getting an Alaska housing loan is it not only keeps the money in Alaska instead of going to Washington, D.C., but you're also going to get more personalized attention if you do have difficulties in your life and it is more difficult for you to potentially. We will work with you, I think, to a greater degree than you're going to see from the large GSEs. And so it's kind of a win-win for Alaska.
Is your default rate comparable to other private sector banking organizations?
Madam Chair, our foreclosure and delinquency rates are extremely low. In fact, they are the lowest we've seen at the corporation in 8 years. Our foreclosure rate is about 0.37%. And our delinquency rate, meaning 30 days or longer delinquent, is sitting a little over 3%. So we are very low right now in a state, Alaska, that has been traditionally over the last 10 or 15 years been one of the five lowest, if not the lowest state in the country in terms of delinquencies and foreclosures. And by that, I mean in very good shape.
And then lastly, Mr. Butcher, on your, it sounded like we were one of a few states and you were the only agency that could manage tax exempt first-time home buyers and veterans. Did I get that right?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And so is it typical in states to have a corporation that is doing that, or in other states do other agencies handle that function?
Madam Chair, all 50 states have a housing finance agency. We are the only one. There are a couple small public housing agencies that have combined with housing like we have, but we are the only statewide one that has made that particular combination.
Mr. Butcher, is there a way to transition into a public-private partnership to take our assets and then hand over the management responsibilities inside the private sector?
Madam Chair, I think that would be very difficult to do because we are listed in federal statute as I think it almost might, in terms of our mortgage business, make need a change in federal statute. I could get back to you on more details on that, but I do know that all 50 states, that's how it's administered, and I have not heard any variance of that anywhere.
Thank you for those additional details. Other questions from committee members? Down the road, okay. Moving on to slide 2.
slide two. Question two, when was the HFC created and how many state funds were invested? If I could have a little latitude, it's a little bit more complicated than just when HFC was created. The Alaska Housing Authority was created by the territorial legislature in 1946, it very much had to do with federal public housing. And then in 1959, under the Alaska Statehood Act, AHA became ASHA, the Alaska State Housing Authority. It managed the public housing portfolio that we now have. In 1971, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation was created, and between the years of 1976 and 1985, a little over $1 billion was invested by the state of Alaska with Alaska Housing, $1,069,000,000, and then you can see the number on slide two. It was set up as a legally independent agency from the state of Alaska, and the main reason for that was they did not want the debts of the corporation to become the debts of the state. So as an example, the debts of the corporation right now in terms of bonds for to fund mortgages is a little over $2 billion. Those are the debts of Alaska Housing. They are not the debts of the state. And so any calculation of debt having to do with the state of Alaska does not include the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Mr. Pritchard.
In 1992, the legislature passed a bill that merged the old Alaska State Housing Authority, ASHA, with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, AHFC. And so we have been operating the public housing side of it as well as the mortgage side of it. And also it added the rural loan program from the old Department of Community and Regional Affairs that also included weatherization and energy programs. So that's how we operate today. The short version is we were created in 1971. We've had a little over $1 billion invested in us. But the long version is we're kind of, as things have been combined, it's combined a number of agencies.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Butcher, on this page 2, under 1856020, it says, the last fragment says, but having a legal existence independent of and separate from the state. What aspects of the business are independent and what are not? In other words, a folks part of the corporation, they're part of the state retirement system. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct.
So if you could separate out what you're independent from, but then again, what are you dependent upon the state for?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we are legally independent in terms of our debt. We are independent in terms of our operating budget has been self-supporting, meaning the budget that run our operations is AHFC receipts that we earn as well as federal funds and other funds. We are not state employees, so we are members of PERS, but we are not in the state health system. We do not pay into SBS. We pay into Social Security. We have our own personnel rules and regs. We have our own procurement rules and regs. So you're correct in that we are in the public employees retirement system, but other than that, we're quite independent for the most part.
Senator Dunleavy, follow up.
Are there bargaining units within AHFC?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, there is. There is one, the Alaska Public Employees Association, APEA.
Thank you.
So just to restate, other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Butcher, one of the questions that keeps coming back is that the number of employees that you have there is just between 300 and 350, and I understand that, you know, they're trying to be independent, but as you look at the retirement system, even though they're not part of SBS or the health, under the health umbrella, what percentage do you pay for your contribution to the PERS system that's out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we pay 22%.
Just like the rest of the departments.
That is correct, Senator.
And the concern that has been voiced in the past is that the number of personnel that are up in the six-digit numbers and those people that are making in excess of what the governor has, The concern has always been that the retirement is also a fairly large liability, and that's what people have pointed out from the district that I come from that's there, and I just wanted to make that clear on the record.
Thank you. Is there a follow-up? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Butcher, how many people are in the bargaining unit?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I believe it's 56, but that can change on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Mr. Butcher, I just pulled the State of Alaska's 2016 Department of Revenue Alaska Public Debt Report, and I see that you're listed. So under state guaranteed debt, I have Alaska Housing Finance Corporation state guaranteed bonds for veteran mortgage program, principal outstanding 56, I believe it's million, yeah, $56,900,000. Total debt service at maturity is going to be $94,600,000. I'm trying to go through the rest of it to see if there's more.
Madam Chair, I can explain that quickly. I was actually going to touch on it when we got to the bonding page, but the only piece of our debt that is that has the GO of the state on it is the tax-exempt veterans loan program. By federal law, it requires each state for it to be a general obligation of the state. So it depends on when bond debt capacity is needed for the program. But when there is, and it's been quite a few years, a bill is passed and it gets on the general election ballot, and the people of the state, and I believe the last time it happened was, I think, 2010. And then the people of the state vote on it. It's always passed with a very high percentage. And so the number we're looking at right now, about 70% is usually what it passes by. And what we're looking at right now, I think, is $46 million. And the only way that liability would ever reach the state, because the corporation's GO is on it kind of in line before the state, is not only would all of the loans have to go south, but the Alaska Housing itself would also have to, and only then would it get to the state of Alaska.
Mr. Butcher, I'm looking at a report that shows about $7 billion worth of outstanding debt, and we're trying to ascertain how much credit raters are looking at and how independent these organizations are. $7.8 billion. Of course, some of that's municipal debt. Some of it's GO bond. $1.3 billion is almost school debt GO bond. Other GO bond port projects come to mind. Anyway. Mr. Butcher, on the page 5 of a 55-page report, Alaska Housing, under state agencies that are collateralized or insured debt, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is listed at $852 million for mortgage revenue bonds. Is that accurate, 2002 through 2011?
Madam Chair, yes, that sounds correct.
And so is there a moral obligation of the state then that exists?
Madam Chair, no, there is not. The only obligation the state has on any of our debt is the $46 million of the Veterans Loan Program.
Are you insuring the debt through the state? Is there some other connection?
Madam Chair, there is not.
Thank you very much. Please continue.
Okay, slide 3. Question 3, what is the current level of funding from the legislature? As you can see, our operating budget for the current fiscal year is $57 million in federal funds, $33 million in corporate funds with a small amount of CIP, and then $800,000 of interagency. Included in that $57 million of federal funds are the voucher funds that kind of pass through from HUD through the corporation out to the landlords. We administer it, but it's really we're really more of a pass-through on it.
Questions from committee members? Please continue.
Slide 4 is the current year's appropriated capital budget. Many of the programs are programs that you see in our request every year. Most of them are are being requested this year as well. And unless you would like me to go through this, Madam Chair, we just kind of listed it in for thoroughness along with our operating budget.
Are there questions on slide 4 for the 2016 appropriated capital budget? Please continue.
Okay. Very briefly on slide 5, Madam Chair, our board of directors are three commissioners: the Commissioner of Revenue, Randy Hoffbeck, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Val Davidson, and the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, Chris Laddick. Our board chair is Brent LaValle of Fairbanks, who fills the statutory position of someone with expertise or experience in finance or real estate. Our vice chair is Marty Shiravloff of Kodiak, who fills the position of a rural resident of the state and or someone who has expertise or experience with a regional housing authority. Alan Wilson of Juneau, who has expertise or experience with residential energy efficient home building or weatherization. And Carol Gore of Anchorage fills the member who would have expertise or experience in the provision of senior or low-income housing. As you can see, we have one public member from the interior, one from South Central, one from Southeast, and one from rural Alaska. And we've always been fortunate enough to have a pretty good regional representation on our board.
Other questions from committee members? Please continue.
Slide 6. Is question 4, what is the management structure? And as you can see, our board of directors are at the top. And then as you look down, you can see in blue the public housing, which is all of the areas of the corporation work together, but they're separated by colors on how the departments came together in the 1992 merger. And so what blue is what used to be the former ASHA. Yellow, operations, finance, mortgage, the more business side of it is in yellow, which was the original Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and then in orange in the middle was the rural housing, or basically the energy department that came over from DCRA.
Please continue.
Slide 7 is question 5, how many employees and how are they funded? The corporation has 313 full-time PCNs and authorization for part-time and non-permanent totaling 350. Approximately half the employees are in the federally funded public housing side and half are in the HFC receipt funded side. And so federal funds along with our mortgage and investment earnings support the operations of the corporation. And I'd already touched on the difference between the HFC employees and state employees. In the last decade, we've seen our employee count for permanent full-time drop from 328 to 313. We're looking at revamping how we look at a lot of the things we do. We're currently working with the University of Alaska Anchorage on a business improvement plan, and I anticipate our number will continue to drop over the next years. I think we can do things more efficiently and more effectively, and so I have a feeling a couple of years from now, 313 is going to be a number larger than what we will be presenting to the Finance Committee.
Switch out a couple of questions. Are there questions from other committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Just a quick one. Mr. Butcher, a couple of years ago, I think we passed a law or enhanced the law to set up a multi-use housing program whereby within a particular building you could have residential facilities but also the ability to make money of business opportunities. Do you recall what I'm referring to?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes I do. I believe it was House Bill 50 at the time.
Okay. Do we know if that's being taken advantage of?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it has. In fact, as we move along, one of the advantage of it has been, I think it's slide 17 that we'll get to, where you can see how a lot of different organizations and groups have all been able to work together to get housing done that wouldn't have previously been able to get done. So I can jump to that, or we can get to it.
That's okay. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. I mean, Mr. Butcher.
Mr. Butcher, this is Senator McKinnon. We don't need to go back on the slides, but earlier on slide two, you indicated that the state had invested almost over $1 billion. Do you have a breakdown whether that was cash, assets, or some kind of instrument? Do you know what that was?
Madam Chair, no, we don't. We can give you a year-by-year breakdown, but since most of it occurred in the late 70s and early 80s, it just shows up in our historical documents as numbers. I would imagine that it probably was cash, but there may have been other things in there that we're not aware of.
And then are we going to get to the point where you've given us operating budget? Are you going to give me a number for total assets that you own right now or have instruments under the corporation?
Madam Chair, we will be coming up to that in just a few slides.
Okay, then on the current slide, on slide seven, can you tell me, under the new Gatsby rules, what are you carrying as an unfunded liability on your books as a corporation for the pension side of the system?
Madam Chair, it's a little under $30 million. It's about $29 million, I think.
Thank you very much.
Slide eight is question six. Does HFC generate revenue? The answer to that question is yes, and we've broken down the different revenue types. We currently have more than 15,000 loans in our portfolio, and as you can see, the mortgage and loan revenue is projected for this fiscal year. So we're just taking a snapshot midway through the fiscal year, but if it continues the way it has been, we'd be looking at, so these are estimates, these are not hard numbers. $128 million in mortgage and loan revenue, externally funded programs, $119 million, and those are federal and state grants, so they have offsetting expenses, they don't generate profit, they come in as revenue and then they go back out again on our books as expenditures. Total investment income of $5.2 million and then other revenue of $12.7 million. Once again, those are just estimates.
Please continue.
Slide 9, question 7, does HFC return a dividend to the state? How much? The answer is yes, and if I could take a few minutes, Madam Chair, I'd love to walk through the entire history of this dividend, because as you can see, it bounces around a little bit, and there are definitely some stories.
Mr. Butcher, we have about 15 minutes left for your presentation, so if you could hit the highlights.
Okay, I'll try to do it quickly. The corporation paid the dividend in the early 90s. At that point, the state of Alaska was interested in being reimbursed the $1 billion that they had invested in the corporation. So you can see from FY 94 to FY 98-99, a tremendous amount was transferred from the corporation to the state. At that point, the corporation began to pay a flat amount of $103 million. The problem became when the net income of the corporation dropped below that into the 90s and then into the 80s. As a result of that, the rating agencies warned the corporation that they could potentially be looking at a downgrade if they continued to pay dividends in excess of the amount of money they were earning. So in 2004, a bill was passed that set in statute a transfer plan which the corporation would pay 95% of its net income and down to 85%, and then in the out years where we are now, 75%. So that's the dividend has been about over the last dozen years. And then, of course, with the historically low interest rates that hit post Great Recession in 08-09, even though the state of Alaska did not take the huge hit to our housing market that we saw in the lower 48, the actions of Congress as a result of that ended up dropping rates low, short-term investments low, and that's why you've seen our dividend drop. Although I'd like to point out that it has gone up from $7 million 2 years ago up to $19 and then $26 million. So we're trending in the right direction, and certainly happy to go into any detail on the dividend as well.
Are there questions for committee members? Mr. Butcher, what do you have in retained earnings?
Madam Chair, about $1.4, $1.5 billion.
Billion, that was with a B, right?
Yes.
Mr. which of the state is in a bit of a revenue shortfall, you might want to take that back to your board of directors and take a look about at your retained earnings to see why you're not providing additional dividend to the state. I don't know how that works, but that's a pretty big retained earning, and I know that there's reasons to have those on your books, but the state may be asking for you to call a call on cash of what we've invested. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that point, Mr. Butcher, have you looked at any contingency plans and looked back in history in the 80s, and you give us a little snapshot of how AHFC stepped in and kind of took over a large amount of properties. I might not be phrasing it right, but here's where I'm going with a question is have you taken a look back in history? You don't have to answer it now. How much cash did you have to make that transition possible on homes and step in, and how much, if you prorated it for inflation, if it was to happen again, how much would you need on hand?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we'll see what we can dig up with that. The corporation back then, when it began repaying the $1 billion in dividends, was considerably larger than it is right now. It was between, I think, $1 billion and $1.5 billion larger than it is right now, and I think that was kind of the motivation, along with budget pressure, to push to get reimbursed from the original money that had established it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Thank you, Mr. Butcher. Please continue.
Slide 10, Madam Chair. I'll try to pick it up a little bit. This simply shows what the dividend has been paid. It's been almost $2 billion. The expenditure has been almost that, and remaining to be paid is $61 million, meaning $61 million of dividend has been appropriated by the legislature but has yet to be expended.
Mr. Butcher, for Alaskans listening, when you pay a dividend to the state, your board usually directs where that dividend should be invested. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, our board approves a budget request, and then our board approves, based on the statutory plan calculation, what the dividend would be. Where it's applied is a decision that first comes out by the governor's office on December 15th, and then ultimately, of course, the legislature decides how it's appropriated.
Mr. Butcher, your board makes recommendations. The governor passes his recommendations through, and then the legislature considers them. Is that fair?
Madam Chair, yeah, I would say that's fair.
Thank you. Please continue.
Slide 11 is question 9. What are HFC's capital assets? Very quickly, our land assets are $20 million, and which 14 of it is public housing land throughout the state that our public housing units are on. And then there are a couple of low-income housing developments in Anchorage that factor into that as well. And so that's a fairly small number. A much larger number is capital assets of our buildings, $93 million. 76 of the 93 are public housing buildings around the state, with the remaining 17 being the office building in Anchorage and a couple of other buildings.
Questions from committee members? Please continue.
Slide 12 lists our non-capital assets. As you can see, they total about $3.6 billion. Mortgage loan and notes. Our mortgage portfolio is 2.8 of that 3.6. Investments and cash are $750 million. About 170 of that are in bond resolutions, and 116 million are restricted by contract. The remaining cash supports operations, $250 million in short-term bonds for self-liquidity, and $230 million for current mortgage commitments. We, as I mentioned earlier, have been doing about $500 million a year of mortgages, and of the liquidity for those mortgages and the operations of the corporation is the main focus there. And then direct financing lease, which is our ownership of the Atwood building and the garage. The Atwood building lease with the state expires in 2017, and then goes from Alaska Housing to the state of Alaska, and the parking garage would be 2027. And the other assets are primarily mortgage foreclosures, homes that we own for short periods of time before we sell, and a couple of other smaller things.
Mr. Butcher, a quick follow-up to a previous slide. Did you tell me that the dividend is paid out statutorily?
Madam Chair, the dividend is, yes, a bill was passed in 2003, I think, that put it in statute, where it lists out the equation, taking a certain percentage of our adjusted change in net assets, as well as a listing of debt service payments on previous capital projects that is factored into what comes out of the dividend.
Thank you very much.
Moving to slide 15, HFC federal funds, can we receive and leverage them? Yes, we're scheduled to receive, slide 13. Does HFC have bonding authority, issued outstanding capacity? The answer is yes. We issue bonds for single-family and multifamily mortgages. It's a lot of the things I've talked about previously. We have about $2.2 billion outstanding as of the end of the last calendar year. That is not debt of the state. It's debt of the corporation. And our annual bonding capacity is limited by state statutes to $1.5 billion, which does not include refundings. We haven't come anywhere near those limits for many, many years. And our qualified tax-exempt bonds are limited by the federal tax law of the IRS.
Mr. Butcher, what interest rate are we charging single-family or multifamily mortgages, first home-time buyer? Is that higher or lower or equal to the private sector?
Madam Chair, it depends on who, and it depends on the time. As of today, our tax-exempt first-time home buyer is 3 5/8. And our taxable is about 3 7/8. And then there are various add-ons. There's a number of programs that change that a little bit. But we are generally competitive with Fannie and Freddie, who are our competitors for interest rates in this area.
I'm writing, Mr. Butcher. You said your annual bond capacity is limited by state statute to $1.5
billion? Madam Chair, that is correct.
Is that each year, so every year you're in existence, that number goes up?
Madam Chair, it is each year. It's not cumulative, though. It's a per-year limit.
How am I supposed to interpret then the bullet point right before that that says we have $2.2 billion of outstanding as of
Madam Chair, that is the total of all the loans that we have taken over the years. That's what we owe in bonds, whereas the $1.5 billion is a limit for what we could do in a single year.
That's what I just asked, whether you could pierce that limit, and I thought you told me no, it was annual, and you had been not close to that. So you're acquiring debt.
Madam Chair, maybe let me see if I can explain it.
Mr. Butcher, if you could just give me a graph of the last 10 years to show me how much new debt you've taken on each of those 10 years, and then where, so I want an annual, and then overlay that with your total accumulative debt for a 10-year period?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. That's great.
Okay, slide 15. Does HFC have any outstanding liabilities the legislature should be aware of? Almost all of it is in the outstanding bonds. We have a few lesser ones having to do with our short-term debt portfolio and interest rate swaps that have been entered into at a cost less than what the corporation would have paid for conventional fixed rate. And then in other liabilities, the majority of that $49 million is the pension liability of $29
million. Senator Machicki has a question. Senator Machicki?
Thank you. Just adding up your capital and non-capital assets and then subtracting your liabilities, looks like you have around $1.3 billion in assets with only capital being about $100 million. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yeah, that is correct. We're at about $1.4 billion, and invested capital assets is about $113 million.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Butcher, my staff said that you actually stated that slot, that last slide we had correctly, and I was the one who didn't hear. I apologize. Please continue.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Slide 15, I touched on that already until I realized I had jumped ahead. Is HFC able to receive and leverage federal funds? Yes, we are, and you can see a breakdown of the $59 million. $35 million are for the voucher program. $3.8 million is for administrative costs of administering the program. $15.4 million for AHFC-owned units in public housing. And then 4.9 for also AHFC-owned units in public housing, just under a different federal program. Slide 16, capital programs with ability to combine federal funding with other mixed funding. I can go through these if you would like, Madam Chair. We mostly just listed them to point out that there's a number of programs that we have that match federal and corporate funds or other funds that we administer.
Are there questions from committee members? I see teacher housing loan programs on here. Senator Dunleavy.
No question. It's just, Mr. Butcher, remember about 15 years ago you and I had a discussion on this issue and we put something together?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I do. I don't know that we'd be talking about this program if we hadn't had that discussion.
Next slide, please.
Okay, slide 17, which touches on what Senator Dunleavy had asked earlier, having to do with the benefits of the legislation that passed a few years ago. Creekview Plaza in East Anchorage is being worked on. It's a mixed-use financing. There'll be commercial in it. There'll be low-income and market. And as you can see in the second paragraph, it involves $3.8 million in loans from Alaska Housing, $2.3 million in senior citizens grant funds, $1.8 million in supplemental funds, $4.3 million in federal tax credits, where a private sector investor comes in and purchases the tax credits. And then Cook Inlet is also putting $2 million of their own funds into it. And the mix of all the different levels of financing and the passage of that legislation giving us flexibility was all necessary to have something like this put together.
Next slide, please.
Slide 18, just briefly, is very similar. Done under HFC's new subsidiary, the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing, which was created by a passage of a bill a few years ago. And this is also a mix of many different funding sources, and one of them being $9 million in federal tax credits, and KeyBank was the private investor that came in and participated there. And without their or private investors stepping up to play a role in it, none of these things could occur as well.
Slide
19, question 11, are there other state entities or private corporations in Alaska that may provide the same or similar services as Alaska Housing? No, we don't believe so. We work with the private sector extensively, and a lot of the companies that are in this arena are companies that rely on us just as we rely on them. We're unique in that we're able to integrate a lot of what we do together. Much of what we do that doesn't have to do with the core operation, such as public housing of the corporation, we try to contract out as much as possible. A good example is the weatherization program, which when it expanded tremendously in the 2008-2009, we did not expand the number of employees and try to become a construction arm of the corporation. We made sure that the money went out to the nonprofits and the regional housing authorities in areas all across the state, which not only benefited those areas with jobs, but also with the skills that those workers have achieved. So even as the program is reduced, there are still skills and work that has been done out there that would not have occurred without the program.
Okay. Mr. Butcher, if I could ask you to move to slide 21.
Sure, Madam Chair. Slide 21 is HFC subject to the state procurement code. No, in 1990, SB 427 passed, providing that HFC adopt its own procurement regulations subject to the provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act. We have done that. It's given the corporation flexibility in dealing on Wall Street with bonds, as well as with the private sector on mortgage loan programs, and all the many federal programs we have. We go through the regulation process, updating it periodically. In fact, we just had procurement regulations updated in December of 2014.
Next slide, please.
Slide 22, and I can just touch on these briefly. These are corporations, subsidiary corporations created by the legislature, who passed the legislation that gave the corporation the ability to create a subsidiary corporation. It was Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation. I know a few folks in the room remember this. Alaska Housing developed this corporation in 2000 and 2001 to securitize some of the revenue flow of the tobacco settlement. And the corporation securitized 80% of it to fund state capital projects. And 20% of it remains in the state operating budget. As you can see, bond proceeds were used to fund a little over $400 million in state capital projects. $350 is still outstanding. Northern Tobacco is legally separate from AHFC, and then, of course, legally separate from the state of Alaska as well. So the debts of this corporation are not the debts of Alaska Housing or the state of Alaska.
Mr. Butcher, I'm looking at my debt report again, page 5 of 55, under state agency debt. State agency debt, it says Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation. 2006, tobacco settlement asset-backed bonds. Principal outstanding, $346 million. Is that a state debt?
Madam Chair, it's a debt of it's a debt of Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, not of the state of Alaska and not of Alaska Housing.
So we'll follow up with our finance team on that particular response. Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Butcher, this particular company within your outfit, basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sold debt based upon future settlement or future tax on tobacco?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, when the tobacco settlement occurred in 99 or 2000, it set up a revenue stream that would come to all of the states that were involved in the lawsuit. And so Alaska had an estimate on what they would take in. There were some potential changes based on how much tobacco use would drop, and the stream could potentially drop. And so the bonds were sold to securitize 80% of that stream. So if the stream were to drop by 50%, it would be 80% of that number. And as a result, the bondholders, that were very sophisticated bondholders at the time, bought the bonds with the understanding that there was a high level of volatility potentially with this, because we were securitizing a stream. And this was done immediately after, I believe, the Casile case, where the state of Alaska was focused on getting rural schools construction funded at a time where there was very little money. And so the bill passed to have Alaska Housing set this up to do that. 1 year to do 40% of the stream, and then a year later to securitize an additional 40%.
Was it, just a quick question, was it junk type of bond? Was it a junk lower grade bond because of the risk?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it was a lower rate bond than you would see from the state of Alaska or Alaska Housing, but it was not a junk bond.
So if we could, I'd like to come back to this one later. I'd like a full presentation on the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation. Is that something the committee's interested in? So, Mr. Butcher, if we could have a presentation prepared on the Northern Tobacco Securitization Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation. Thank you, Senator Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, we would be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. And I know that you sent us a historical paper that I did read that included NTSC. Next slide.
Slide 23, Madam Chair, the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation. This was created in 2006 by a bill for the corporation to create a subsidiary for the purpose of financing various capital projects in the state. And it was initially funded with $300 million appropriation from the state general fund. The current balance is $44 million. 23 of the 44 has been appropriated and just hasn't been expended, and it has a balance of approximately $21 million.
Mr. Butcher, we'd like to include that as a topic with the NTSC's presentation to give us a little bit more understanding of that. When you talked about capitalization and $1 billion, just over $1 billion at the beginning of your presentation, are these subsidiary corporations part of that investment?
Madam Chair, they are not. We act with the using the example of the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation. We created the subsidiary that holds the funds. We manage it, but we have no access to it. It's legally separate from Alaska Housing. It's just a standalone corporation for the benefit of state capital projects.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, it's a request for you, Madam Chair. When the report is put together by Mr. Butcher, can it include things like mission, purpose, board members? Does the corporation that was created, does it still function and carry out its mission, or is it has it exhausted its bonding capacity and it just sits there, et cetera, et cetera?
Mr. Richard, Madam Chair, we would be happy to include all of those things.
Thank you.
And then I believe the last slide, Madam Chair, the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing. This, we reference with our Ridgeline Terrace development, was established by legislation 4 years ago, I believe, that allowed the corporation to form a subsidiary that could develop, manage, and operate affordable housing with a little bit more flexibility, and that's what was needed to develop the housing that KeyBank, as a tax credit investor, and a number of Rasmussen Foundation, and a number of other partners all came together to do that. So it's a relatively new corporation. It's had one development done in it, but it's been successful to the degree that it's been around.
Mr. Butcher, how many were there state dollars invested into that?
About $1.3 million.
Madam Chair, about $1.3 million.
Mr. Butcher, when we come back, we would like all of your subsidiary corporations to know the basically the same 12 questions that we just asked about Alaska Housing Finance. And then if we can get some kind of understanding of how the money came into the corporations, how the money has went out of the corporations, and we'll just try to follow the money there.
We'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair. Just a point that all of these corporations were created by legislative action and not at the request of the last one. Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing was done at the request of Alaska Housing, but the other two were things that we, responsibilities that we were willing to take on.
We appreciate the way that you have manage the assets at the direction that the legislature has provided you. My staff sent me another note and said that the bond report that I'm looking at shows all debt for the state, and that we've confirmed, as you have stated, that there is no state obligation under that commercial paper that I mentioned earlier. Thank you for that. Is there any additional questions for Mr. Butcher? I know that you have multiple people. We've been, you have Stephen Kantner, who's been following us online for some time. I just wanted Mr. Butcher to make sure you were aware that he was online. I know that you have three other members of your staff available in a room with you. I believe that's Mike Strand, Les Campbell, and Stacey Schubert. So I just wanted to thank all of you for joining us in the Senate Finance Committee room today. Is there any closing comments for our consideration?
I don't have any, Madam Chair. Just thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to present.
Is there questions, final questions from committee members? I have a final question. On your retained earnings, Mr. Butcher, is there a board policy on retained earnings, or is there something in Alaska state statute?
Madam Chair, it's discussions we have with our board regularly, but I don't think we have anything specifically set in our rules or regs or anything that pertains to that.
So that might be something that you can follow back up with us on. $1.4 billion of retained earnings, I assume that's cash?
Madam Chair, no, it's not cash. It's a number of things. Cash plays a role in it. Mortgage loans are a big piece of it. A lot of it's restricted by contract. It's in reserve funds for bonds. It's in a number of things. The actual cash amount isn't a whole lot larger than what we need to keep liquidity for funding mortgages and the operations of the corporation.
Is it fair to say retained earnings are something we own?
Madam Chair, yes, I would say that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? Tomorrow, Friday, March 18th, at 9 a.m., the Senate Finance Committee will convene. We will be hearing under bills previously heard, SB 1, and I'm losing the other one. I think it's 126. We had the Commission on Aging, 124. Thank you, Donnie. SB 124 will be back before the body. With that, we're adjourned.